Good evening and welcome to Eco Radio KC. On tonight's program, we bring you excerpts from this past weekend's Kicking the Coke Habit Conference. But first, here's Teresa Wilkie with some news.
Last week, Family Farm Action launched a TV and social media campaign to call on our Congress to pass a bipartisan farm bill. Mike Murphy interviewed a spokesperson with Family Farm Action.
Well, my name is Jake Davis with Family Farm Action. Just wanted to share that Family Farm Action has issued a national ad campaign opposing the King Amendment to the Farm Bill. We've launched that ad campaign in a 5-state area with on television with a follow-up of social media campaign to ask Congress to reject the King Amendment and avoid poisoning the Farm Bill process with the King Amendment, which would eliminate states' rights on a huge number of state laws. So we would love to see Congress avoid that in the conference committee and pass something very similar to the Senate bipartisan farm bill.
What is it specifically in the King Amendment that you are concerned with?
Yeah, we're very concerned that the King Amendment would eliminate states' rights and eradicate a huge number of laws that govern the way agriculture works all across the country. So we're very geographically diverse, and each state has their own sets of laws, including things like regulation of the transportation of diseased livestock or firewood, and we also recognize that those states need those rights to protect their farmers, and so we're very concerned that the King Amendment would eradicate that.
Family Farm Action is a coalition of family farmers and advocates building the political muscle to fight for farmers in rural communities. Thursday, August 2nd, Andrew Wheeler, acting administrator at the EPA, announced Trump's decision to roll back fuel efficiency standards to 37 miles per hour on automobiles, which will surely add additional global warming emissions to our atmosphere. August 10th, a jury in California found Monsanto liable in a lawsuit filed by Dwayne Johnson, who alleged the company's glyphosate-based weed killers caused his terminal cancer. Monsanto was ordered to pay $289 million in damages to Johnson. There are more than 5,000 similar lawsuits pending. The jury in the Johnson suit found Monsanto failed to warn users of their glyphosate-based weed killers of cancer risks posed by those weed killers. A divided federal appeals court on Thursday ordered the EPA to ban a widely used pesticide that critics say endanger children and farmers. The 2-1 decision by the 9th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in Seattle overturned former EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt's March 2017 denial of a petition by environmental groups to halt the use of chlorpyrose on food crops such as fruit, vegetables, and nuts. One of the workshops at the Kicking the Coke Habit Conference this past weekend was provided by Craig Wolf with Heartland Renewable Energy. Climate Emergency, the Case for Immediate Action. Here's Craig.
But what I want to accomplish today is to get people in this room to understand the nature of the issue, that it is an existential crisis, and that you will say, I am going to do more than I have done. I'll become a stronger activist. That's what I want to accomplish today. And throughout this, we will ask ourselves the questions: if the climate crisis is a real emergency, what should that look like? What should it look like? We'll talk about that. But we're going to start with this. This is a clock of the Earth, 4.5 billion years. And this start of this clock represents the formation of the moon. And there's all kinds of asteroids and all kinds of stuff banging into the Earth. we get in here, and this is where life started to happen, the Cambrian period. And right here is where the dinosaurs came and the dinosaurs left. And right here, we can see not so clearly, is when humans, our ancestors, first began. Not really humans, but our ancestors. And that was 2 million years ago. So let's see if we can see that. You know, I still have a hard time. Not yet. There we go. This little pink sliver is the 2 million years out of those 4.5 billion years that we have been on the planet. So it took 4.5 billion years to create this miracle for life on the planet and for us to inhabitate the planet and basically overwhelm the planet. And we are in the process of kicking out the underpinnings that have made life the miracle that has made life possible on the planet. And I used to have this set of slides. This is a fairly new set here. But I used to put this at the end. But I thought, no, I want to take this and put it at the very beginning, because this really sets the foundation emotionally and informationally for what I want to talk about. So extinction events or mass extinctions occur when the current rate of species extinction significantly exceeds the typical background rate. And by back, come on, have a seat. Typically exceeds the normal background rate. So species normally go extinct all the time. So here are the five, what we call, major mass extinctions. And I read a book by Elizabeth Colbert, K-O-L-B-E-R-T, I believe, called The Sixth Extinction. If you're interested in this topic, read it. So we've heard of these. This is where the dinosaurs came and went here. And this is called the Great Dying, where some 90% of life on the planet went out. And what was the catalyst for that extinction was the same thing that we're worried about, carbon. Now, it happened through different things going on. The Earth was in a totally different phase in its creation, but it was too much carbon in the atmosphere. So this extinction event took somewhere between 60,000 and 48,000 years from it to occur. This next one, it happened a little quicker for whatever reason. It took 5,000 years for the mass extinction to run its course. And the dinosaurs, that extinction, actually took 32,000 years. Now, our extinction, believe it or not, is happening faster than any of these. I mean, geological scale, what? We know we've been around for 6,000 years, at least from a historical standpoint. So we've got plenty of time to knock off the planet. So there's a guy named Doug Irwin. He's a paleontologist at the Smithsonian National Museum of Natural History. And the way he puts it is, you don't want to start a mass extinction, because once a mass extinction begins, the prognosis is pretty grim. And I'll have a slide on this later on. At present rate, the rate of extinction of species is about, right now, is about 100 to 1,000 times higher than the normal background rate, typical rates of extinction. Therefore, our current rate of extinction is 10 to 100 times higher than any of the previous mass extinctions in the history of the Earth. I'll read that again. Our current rate of extinction right now is 10 to 100 times higher than that of any of the previous mass extinctions in the history of the Earth. That's because it just doesn't go. Even when the comet hit in the Gulf of Mexico, it still took thousands of years for that to run its course and wipe out, you know, 45-50% of the species on the planet. So mass extinction. Be thinking about this with this. And anybody, can anybody tell me what that is?
Sun.
Huh?
Our sun?
No, that's us. That's our Earth. And this, these are stripes, are just photographic stripes. But I like this slide. This is from, who's the guy? Billions and billions of years ago. What's his name? Carl Sagan.
Yeah.
This is one of his slides. And the reason I like this is because it really says, this is really a little miracle that we've got here, that everything that we have here to create life is right there. And it also tells me that there's no night on a white horse in shining armor that's going to come rushing in and say, well, here, I'm going to come in and fix your carbon problem for you. Hang on, folks. If we make a mess, it's our mess, and there's nobody going to clean it up. This is, I've made up a story about this, but it's, I've also read that it's kind of true. This is from Apollo 8. And this is when they went around the Earth, or around the Moon, and they came out on the other side. And this was the first time they'd seen the Earth. And of course, all they have is this little window in their capsule. And my story that I totally made up is, when the astronaut saw that, he says, "Somebody quick, hand me the camera." So that's what he shot this shot. And it has certainly changed their lives. Those astronauts' lives, every one of them, their lives are changed. This is called the Blue Marble. And this is taking a shot of the sun with, or shot of the Earth with the sun right behind. Actually, the sun is probably a little bit over here when they shot the shot, because you can see it's a little cloudy over there. But that is the most published photograph ever. Now, this is a shot. We're starting to get into the science of these things now. So this is the horizon, and this is the atmosphere. We're going to zoom in on that a little bit. And this is our atmosphere. It's very fragile. It's very thin. And to describe how thin that is, our old buddy Carl Sagan, if we had in the classrooms they have a globe and they can spin it around. If we took shellac or varnish and we varnished that globe and let it dry, the thickness of our atmosphere relative to the thickness and volume of the Earth is about the same as that shellac on that classroom globe. So it is very fragile, it is very thin, and we are very lucky to have it. So, what is going on here? What is causing the climate crisis? Well, it starts out by shortwave radiation in terms of light waves going through the atmosphere. And then once it goes through the atmosphere, most of that radiation is absorbed by the Earth and it warms the Earth. And some of that bounces back out into outer space. But some of that radiation bounces back to Earth. That's the greenhouse effect. It has worked miraculously over the eons to give us just the amount of heat that we need for the planet. So what has gone wrong is, and kind of pay attention, now this depiction of the atmosphere is exaggerated, but we're going to take a look at that atmosphere. It's gotten bigger, and now the nature of the atmosphere and the particles that are in it is long-wave radiation heat is now bouncing back to the Earth, and that's why we're experiencing warmer temperatures.
That was Craig Wolf in his workshop for the conference, The Climate Emergency, The Case for Immediate Action. We'll hear more from Craig after these messages.
Again, by itself, none of these are evidence, proof that we have climate change that's occurring. But you start adding them up. In Texas, in 2015, and then again in Texas, 2017, they also had a giant storm in 2016. Hurricane blast through Florida, September 2017, followed by Hurricane Maria, which devastated Puerto Rico. Those poor Puerto Ricans. It's happening all over the planet, in Chile, in France, in Georgia near Russia, in Germany, in China. Japan, India. It's happening all over the planet. It's not a fluke. The other side of the coin is drought. In Brazil, 140 cities had to ration water, and one-fifth of the population was affected by the drought. California has not escaped, and they're suffering now from the wildfires, which are related to the drought, and all the fuel that's fallen on the floor of the forest. And then when a wildfire starts, it's too hot, it's too dry. They're in the middle of a drought. This is what Lake Folsom looked like in 2011. Here's Lake Folsom in 2014. People are getting nervous. The U.S. Department of Defense said climate change will likely lead to food and water shortages, pandemic disease, disputes over refugees and resources, and destruction by natural disasters in regions across the globe. Here's a farmer. He had 400 acres of wheat, and it is now turned to desert. This is in Syria. 2006 to 2010, 60% of their farmland turned to desert. And by 2010, the drought had killed 80% of the country's cattle. This led to, along with the political process, this is what that one slide was talking about, along with the political phenomena, now you've got climate change that's exacerbating a political problem. This is everybody trying to get into Europe. Here's Miami on a normal day. This is called high tide. Everybody who has to walk from one place to the other takes off their shoes and walks through the water. This is the poster child for climate change. They're trying to figure out, what the heck are we going to do? One of the industries that's going to be the canary in the cage that they used to drop down, they'd listen to a canary in the coal mine. What they're talking about is they'd take a canary and they could hear him chirping away. When he stopped chirping, they'd say, ooh, bad air. So the canary in our coal mine for climate change is our insurance industry. You can't get insurance in many of the coastal areas anymore, or it costs you too much. Projected sea rise in Florida, 2 feet by 2060, 3 to 4 feet, maybe 7 feet or more by the turn of the century. Where'd Miami go? Used to be here. When we had that training in Miami, we flew into Miami, and I'm looking out the window because I always like to sit by the window. Boy, flat. They don't have a chance. Talk about insurance, $129 billion worth of New York real estate now lies in flood zones. We talked about coral reefs. Coral reefs are the key to life in the oceans and soon be gone. 80% of coral reefs in the Caribbean are gone, and 40 to 50% are gone worldwide. 49% of species have declined from 1970 to 2012. One of the things that happens is the oceans do its job of absorbing all this heat and carbon into the oceans. Because of the excess carbon that it's absorbing, that carbon becomes carbonic acid. And you've got the foundation of life in the ocean being these little crustaceans that have a shell on their backs. And there's a lot of critters that are a little bit bigger than them that rely on those creatures for their sustenance. The shell starts dissolving, those creatures will die. The little bit bigger creatures die because the little creatures are gone, and the creatures above them, and the creatures above them, and the creatures above them. The oceans are threatened right now for their very existence. And the oceans may die as they did in that great dying picture we saw. Humanity is collectively mismanaging the ocean to the brink of collapse, World Wildlife Fund. The vast majority of carbon reserves are unburnable. What does that mean? Oil companies, the biggest industry on the planet, has invested in these oil reserves all over the place. What that means is 70 to 80% of these oil reserves, their piggy bank for the future, if we burn them, we die. We have to leave 70 to 80% of these oil reserves in the ground if we stand a chance of surviving climate change. And you wonder why oil industries and the Koch brothers put out these organizations like the Heartland Foundation or ALEC, which is the American Legislative Exchange Council, that come up with all this bad legislation and they feed it to these Republican or conservative legislators in the state houses, and they push through all this legislation. Unburnable. So let's play the odds. Let's roll the dice on climate. Let's talk about insurance a little bit. What are the chances that your house will burn down? 1 in 100,000? You don't have a very strong chance. You don't wake up in the middle of the night and worry about, God, I don't have insurance on my house. Of course you have insurance on your house. But the odds are very small that your house is going to burn down, but you still pay on. I pay about $1,000 a year on my house. Now, this is not at all about nuclear power, but this is about decision making. So don't, I'm not, in this set of slides, I'm not pro or anti-nuclear energy. But let's build a nuclear power plant. We had a Three Mile Island, we had a Chernobyl plant, and we had a Fukushima meltdown in Japan. So we have experience with bad things happening with nuclear power plants. So when we build a nuclear power plant, we're extremely careful. So what are the odds of a nuclear disaster? So let's make up a story. And this is a town hall, and they're going to build a nuclear power plant about 30 or 40 miles outside of Lawrence, Kansas. And so there's a town hall meeting, and this is one of the engineers here, and somebody raises their hand in the audience, and they said, well, what are the odds that this thing's going to collapse and break down and spew radiation all over the place? And he says, well, according to our numbers, it's, 5% chance that that'll happen, maybe 10% chance. So it's pretty low. And the audience, their jaws, everybody's silent, because they say, 5 or 10% chance of a nuclear meltdown? You gotta be kidding me. What are the odds of a climate disaster if we don't do anything? If we keep doing the way we're doing now, is it 5%? Is it 10%? Is it 50%? Is it 75%? We don't know for sure, but if we don't do anything, I guarantee you it's more than 5 or 10% that we'll get into that extinction thing.
That was Craig Wolf at his workshop for Kicking the Coke Habit this past weekend. After these messages, we'll hear from Joe Spies, chair of the Kansas Sierra Club, and his workshop, The Koch Brothers Fight Against the Science of Climate Change.
I want to begin by just making you aware of a conference that took place just a couple of days ago. It was called the America First Energy Conference in New Orleans. It just happened 2 days ago. It was hosted by some of the country's most vocal climate change doubters, and it was attended by a handful of Trump administration officials. It was the second annual conference for this America First Energy, and it was organized by the think tank funded by the Koch brothers, Heartland Institute. And it pulled together speakers from, there's an organization called Junk Science, and all they do is put out information that is supposed to challenge the legitimate science done by the climatologists and others. And then there was another group called the Committee for a Constructive Tomorrow and the Center for Industrial Progress, along with officials from the U.S. Department of the Interior and then and the White House, for panels that included, quote, carbon taxes, cap and trade, and other bad ideas, unquote. Now, and we know this issue of carbon taxes, cap and dividend, all these things have been studied by legitimate economists, and they've determined that if you have a system where you're taxing carbon and you're using those taxes to and distributing them to people, especially in low-income areas where they can develop energy efficiency programs to help lower their energy use, which is, for the time being, dominated by fossil fuels, this is a very good thing. So that's kind of a crazy subject for conference presentation. Another one was fiduciary malpractice, the sustainable investment movement. And all they did here was attack this movement that's really gaining momentum now, encouraging corporations to divest from fossil fuel companies. And it's really having a positive effect. Economically, if you look at what's happening now, the more you divest from fossil fuel companies, the harder it is for them to function. And it helps to accelerate this transition to renewable energy and more energy efficiency, which all of which the fossil fuel companies are not involved in. And then, of course, they had another session called Why CO2 Emissions Are Not Creating a Climate Crisis, which is, that's just the icing on the cake. That's that was kind of the basis of this whole thing. They just deny the science. I like to use examples on this, and I'm going to get to them later, but it's on a slide that I'll make clear to help explain why that's nonsense. They created a pamphlet that was called Dumb Energy, and I think that pretty much speaks to the level of intelligence, the people who were at this conference, too. Dumb Energy, and then it just had pictures of wind turbines and solar modules on the cover of the pamphlet, and then it was just a 10-page thing, and it just tried to explain that you don't want this clean stuff. It's just no good. It's dumb. And then they had some other panels where they were talking about how carbon dioxide makes the planet greener. And you know, once you really dive into this, when you're looking at the science of this stuff, you can knock all this stuff out. But think about who's attending this. And then they had their largest session was about how the United Nations puts out fake science because the United Nations' real goal is to control the global energy market. So watch out. It's just crazy. Now we'll get into this thing a little bit. I'm going to make sure all my clickers are working here. I wanted to give you, before I get into the actual work that they do to fight the science of climate change, I wanted to give you a little background on the Koch family so you know where they come from and how they evolved to the point where they're so determined to attack the science and try and convince people that climate change isn't real. I hope you can read all this. Start at the top and then we'll move left to right. Their daddy, Fred Koch, owned oil refineries, and a long time ago, this is right after the turn of the century in the early 1900s, he was working for an oil company called Universal, and they developed a new refining technique that allowed them to handle dirtier types of oil, the cruder crude. And Daddy Fred Koch actually stole that technology and split off and tried to develop oil refineries in the United States on his own, but the guy who owned Universal sued him, wouldn't allow that, and said, "You stole my technology, you can't do that, you're going to go to prison unless you cease and desist." And so here he was, with this ability to just steal this technology, and he knew he could make a lot of money with it, so what did he do? And this is, in some ways, it's hilarious, in others, it's tragic. He went to the Soviet Union, connected to Stalin, and for several years developed about 15 refineries using his technique, which is the same technique that was originated by these other people, made an absolute fortune from Stalin and the Russians, and then had this gigantic bankroll that allowed him to come back to the United States and fight the legal suit against him. And it's just so ironic. Here they for the longest time, they were just anti-communist, this and this and that and the other. Their whole company bankroll got started from working with Stalin in the Soviet Union. That's beyond ironic. And, of course, Daddy Fred, they have the Kochs have, and their whole family, going back to the granddaddy, have a really sordid history in funding organizations connected to racism and bigotry. And Daddy Fred was the largest single funder of the John Birch Society. Then, moving over here now, in 1957, Daddy Fred left Charlie and David what amounts to about $1 billion in today's money. The myth about Charlie and David is that, oh, they pulled themselves up by their bootstraps. They're self-made men. Oh, please. You know, in 1957, the profit from the company that Fred had built up was close to $60 million. That was their net profit. So the assets that it took to generate that amount of profit was huge. And that's what Charlie and David inherited. So this myth about how they were self-made men and all this nonsense. And then we know about the things they've done. They helped start the Tea Party. And today they're a huge influence on the Republican Party. They annually raise about $400 million. In this midterm election, they're raising $400 million to go after Democrats with Republicans. They're each worth somewhere between $40 and $55 billion. The latest thing says it's between $53 and $55, whatever. It's just gigantic sums of money. They're one of the top two privately held companies in the United States with annual revenues of $115 billion. The other, the top company, is Cargill. And they've paid out a record civil and criminal environmental penalties. They use a management philosophy called market-based management, which is nothing more than allowing their pipelines and other things to degrade to the point where they're dangerous as a way of saving money. And this largest criminal penalty that they paid out is just a tragic result of that market-based management nonsense. What happened was, in this pipeline, it was about 60 miles southeast of Dallas. And I'll get into this about all their pipeline stuff. There was a pipeline carrying butane. And with this market-based management philosophy, they had allowed it to corrode. And this family, this young kid, he's 16, and his girlfriend were over at the folks' place, and they're sitting around, and the kid goes, oh, my God, I smell gas. And so he said, you've got to go tell the sheriff. So the kid and his girlfriend drive off in the pickup. They hit a low-lying area where the gas had settled, and it choked the carburetor on his pickup and killed it. The kid didn't know what was going on. He didn't know that that's what happened. And when he tried to restart it, the spark from the ignition ignited that gas and incinerated those two young kids, burned them to a crisp. So the father of the boy took the Kochs to court. It ended up in a $296 million settlement. And in the course of the investigation, the thing that hurt the Kochs is when they checked out this pipeline, they found 596 areas where it was corroded beyond allowable levels. So they just allow things to... By saving operations and maintenance money, they make money. So they think. And then they just try to use the courts to their advantage. This time they got nailed. And it's sad. It was just completely tragic. They're one of the top three polluters of water and air and climate. Exxon and AEP is American Electric Power, are the other two. They produce, and I underline tons here, 25 million metric tons of greenhouse gases annually. That's just Koch Industries. That is a massive amount of pollution. That's millions of tons. Now, I'm going to get back to millions of tons of emissions here in a little while. But then here, they own, and this isn't all the things that they own. They own a bunch of other stuff, paper companies, all this stuff. But on the fossil fuel and chemical side, 4 oil refineries, 6 ethanol plants, a natural gas power plant, 4,000 miles of pipeline. I should have included some of the fertilizer plants and things, since those are so dependent on natural gas feeds too. But keep in mind, that's just the fossil fuel side. Now, I apologize. I know this is a little fuzzy and a little hard to see, and I did everything I could to try and create a little bit more visual clarity, but I couldn't do it. But in a way, it doesn't matter, because the thing that's important to understand about this chart is that they deliberately create this tangled web to confuse people about where the sources of money come from for all the things they do to attack the science of climate change and other things. Look at all this stuff. And I want to point out that most of the money comes from either Freedom Partners, this TC4 Trust, or the Center to Protect Patient Rights. And you can see it just goes all over the place. And they're just funding a bunch of different things. Since I knew that wouldn't be very readable, I had to create this next slide. Oh, please. This happened earlier. This thing cycles off, and I have to. There we go. The things that you're probably familiar with that they fund include the American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC. And how many of you are familiar with ALEC? Okay, so you know, all they do is they create legislation that they take to state legislatures around the country and try and shove it through. And then the State Policy Network, Americans for Prosperity, I'll be getting back to them for something specific they did in Kansas, the Heartland Institute, and they were the ones that funded that WACO conference down in New Orleans the other day, Freedom Partners, the Heritage Foundation, the Cato Institute is supposed to be a libertarian think tank, but we know that the only reason the Koch brothers are connected to anything libertarian is so they have some way of putting lipstick on the pig of their efforts to knock government and regulation. And then the America Future Fund. And if you knew about some of the things they're doing, part of this is that these things are funding their efforts to infiltrate our colleges and universities around the country. They are paying for around 100 or so professors to spread their poison to young people through our colleges and universities. And it's as close as Kansas University, where they paid $12 million to create a special office in the Department of Economics. And so Art Hall generally will be there to talk about the wonders of trickle-down economics, but his real job is to bring a level of expertise to the Kansas legislature whenever there's a bill they want to introduce that they need, where they need a defense of someone who has a little intelligence. They'll trot Art Hall out, and he'll go and say, oh, that fossil fuel stuff is the cheapest stuff out there. All this stuff you read about subsidies and healthcare costs is just a bunch of nonsense. So he's just a stooge for the Koch brothers. Now, as we move into how they attack climate change, the Koch brothers made a very deliberate effort to plant people into the Department of Energy. After Trump was elected, they knew it was going to be real easy to get some of their key stooges stuck into the Department of Energy. The first one I want you to know about is Sophie Miller. And while she was working for the Koch brothers out of Koch Industries in Wichita, her job was to criticize the Department of Energy and the Environmental Protection Agency and to deny climate change. And then in 2012, she moved into a job. They got her a job at George Washington University's Regulatory Studies Center, which they have turned into an anti-government and anti-regulation research organization that just supports their those positions. Then Sophie moved to George Mason University to the Koch-funded Mercatus Center, which receives, I think, the most Koch brothers money of any university in the country. And the Mercatus Center is it's infamous from this last week. I don't know if you saw it. I laughed so hard. The Mercatus Center is the one that was paid by the Koch brothers to do their study on Medicare for All, a single-payer healthcare system. And they came back with the conclusion that a Medicare for All system would actually save citizens $2 trillion over 10 years. And the Koch, the Koch brothers are freaking out. And of course, Bernie Sanders was quick to jump on the internet and go, "I'd like to thank the Koch brothers for endorsing my Medicare for All system." It was one of the funniest things I've seen. Well, anyway, but now, as soon as Trump was elected, she left the Mercatus Center and they planted her into the Department of Energy to reform energy efficiency standards. The Koch brothers have an all-out war on this because the more energy efficiency programs that are in place, the less fossil fuels we're using, and that hurts them. So they're all that. And then she's not alone, and there are many more. Dandy Dan Simmons. I've heard this guy speak, and it is just comical because he will tell you things. He'll look you in the eye and tell you stuff that is just a complete lie. But his big job for the Koch brothers, when he worked directly for them, was to attack renewable energy groups, the Solar Energy Industries Association, the American Wind Energy Association, and then deny climate change. He was just all over the place talking about what a joke that was and how there's this conspiracy amongst the scientists. And then, of course, another thing that the Kochs do is, for the longest time, he was the head of their efforts to spread monies to any candidate who would deny climate change. And that was part of his job. And now, so first he became vice president of the American Energy Alliance. In 2016, he was famous, and this did make the news. He was giving testimony in Congress where he said, "We need budget cuts to just get rid of the Department of Energy and especially at least end EERE, Energy Efficiency and Renewable Energy, that department within the Department of Energy." So he just wanted to get rid of it. It doesn't do any good. Why not just get rid of it? And of course, now he's the director of EERE at the Department of Energy and is leading efforts to deny science, the science of climate change, et cetera.
That was an excerpt from Joe Spee's workshop, "The Koch Brothers Fight Against the Science of Climate Change." The entirety of both Craig Wolf and Joe Spee's workshops is posted on the Eco Radio KC Facebook page. The calendar of events will follow after these messages. This is Teresa Wilkie, and I'm going to give you the calendar of events. Tuesday, August 14th, 6:30 to 8:30 p.m., the Kansa Group of the Sierra Club is hosting a free event, Building a Resilient Third Congressional District, at Colonial Church in Prairie Village, 7039 Mission Road. Speakers are Tom Jacobs with Mid-America Regional Council and Ward Lyles with KU. The Lawrence Makerspace Reuse Treasure Sale is this weekend, 8/18 and 8/19, from 8 a.m. to 2 p.m. at the corner of 11th and Massachusetts, Lawrence, Kansas. August 23rd, 6 to 8 p.m. at the Best Conference Center, KU Edwards Campus, 12600 Quivira Road, Overland Park, Climate Energy Project invites us all to attend a public hearing for Kansas City Power and Light customers about proposed rate changes, some of which could have positive outcome for clean energy, but some which might discourage homeowners from choosing solar to power their homes. Also on August 23rd at 7 p.m. at the Lawrence, Kansas Public Library, 7th in Vermont, there's a free event sponsored by Grassland Heritage Foundation, Native Plant Garden Workshop. Saturday, September the 8th, thousands of Rise for Climate rallies and marches will be held around the world. Each of these events will be calling local leaders to commit to building a fossil fuel-free world that puts people and justice before profits. In the Metro Kansas City area, 350 KC and the Sustainability Sanctuary Coalition are co-sponsoring a Rise March, 8 a.m. to 10 a.m. Marchers will call on Johnson County and all municipalities in the county to commit to building a 100% clean energy future. Tuesday, September the 11th, the Kansas Sierra Club Topeka Group invites you to hear a speaker, Judy Scherf, Washburn University biology professor, whose subjects include the human impact on the environment. She will talk about the oceans, how oceans affect the climate, the consequences of human interaction with the oceans. This will be 7 p.m. at the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship, 4775 Southwest 21st in Topeka, Kansas.